Hi everyone, and welcome to the oneliner.com podcast. I'm Craig Eastman, coming to you as always from the ever mucky banks of the River Mersey in just outside Liverpool, and in Glasgow is site editor Scott Morris.
Hello.
And in Brighton's Falkirk is site contributor Drew Tavendale.
Good evening.
Got a bit of a mixed bag to cover with you this time around, so we'll crack on. I hope you enjoy the show, and if you don't, stick it up your ass. Bangkok Dangerous sees Thai directorial brother act Danny and Oxide Pang return to their 1999 original, this time with Hollywood money and marketing, as is de rigueur. This time, starring the descendant Nick Cage plays the central character of Joe, a foreign hitman in Bangkok with a number of jobs to do and a problem in that his love affair with a local woman and grudging affection for his usually disposable errand boy are beginning to compromise his work ethic. The original was one of a number of films at the spearhead of the Eastern cinema seepage at the turn of the millennium and won some acclaim for its directorial style and tough signature Asian violence. Crucially though, this time around, with an American audience to please, its central character is no longer a deaf mute, Hollywood reluctant to pay a big name like Cage big dollars to keep shtum. Oh, and even more crucially this time around, it's considerably more bab. Scott, you seem to quite like Bangkok Dangerous first time around, giving it 4 stars back in May of 2003. What see ye this time around?
You'd say it's a massive disappointment if you couldn't already sort of see this kind of thing coming. I guess the rapid evaporation of this film when exposed to audiences will put paid to the notion that Nick Cage can actually open a film these days. It seems to have vanished very, very quickly, despite having advertisements on every other bus that I saw for about 2 months going into it. So, bit of a flop. The original was born of that sort of Asian, Hong Kong-y, action-y, John Woo-y sort of school. And while there's elements of that in this version, there's also a very definite attempt to try and reach a kind of more mainstream American audience. And as a result, it's sort of found itself fallen somewhere between the two in a position that's not particularly of any use. And that's the good bits. The bad bits are bits like Cage's just woefully unbelievable relationship with the mute pharmacy girl, the love interest, who's just entirely tacked on, and it feels incredibly silly, and those parts of the film bear no relation in either tone or, well, sense to the rest of the film. Complete padding. If you took those bits out, there's at least elements in the rest of it that I like. There are a few halfway decent action sequences, but there's certainly nothing like enough to save it.
What confused me was the decision, obviously, to no longer have the central character as the deaf-mute to dispose of that. But for some reason, they've seen fit to imbue that characteristic upon, as you say, a completely tacked-on character. And this time it's the love interest who's a deaf-mute. And it doesn't seem to serve any sort of thematic purpose as I could see.
I mean, in terms of relationship to the original Bangkok Dangerous, the only thing that's the same is that it's in Bangkok and is roughly about Hitman.
Who's quite dangerous.
Yeah. Every other detail has been changed, and it's just throwing these bits in. Like, the whole deaf-mute thing, I think, is more just a nod to try and have some sort of vague connection to the previous ones, and it's pretty much an irrelevance. It does pain me somewhat to be critical of a film where someone gets bisected by a close-range grenade blast. But even with that, I still can't be all that positive about Bangkok Dangerous. Let's say, if you are a genre fan of the sort of Hong Kong action stuff, which I think most of us would have grown up with, then there's the odd element in there that's almost interesting. And I suppose, if nothing else, it's a reasonably brutal film in a time where action films tend to be quite sanitised.
Mm.
So there's that recommending it, but it's a very minor recommendation, at least. I think mainstream audiences and, well, just audiences in general were quite right to ignore this. I can't really bring myself to get too upset and start slagging it, because it's not too terrible a film, but it's certainly not a good film. And
what is it about the American market that makes acclaimed Asian directors want to travel across the travel across the ocean and almost without fail neuter themselves in the strange process of remaking their own films in a different country?
Yeah, baffling. I can think of very few successful crossovers.
I think only John Woo has escaped the cycle of not actually remaking his own films. Every other one that seems to have come across. I forget your fella's name, the director of the Grudge films.
Oh,
It's escaped you as well. There seems to be the strap of Hollywood directors across, but not to direct new material, just to remake their own, which is completely purposeless and invariably a massive mistake. Yeah. If they were popular enough for the American audience to enjoy the films to an extent where the studios want to bring them over, why castrate them and decide that the American audience can't handle the things they clearly liked in the first place?
I mean, yeah. The Grudge is a bad example because that guy has been making the same film six times by this point because they're all the Gion films are exactly the same, and there's telly ones before that were exactly the same. Yeah. And it does throw up these little strange things like The Ring, where Hideo Nakata didn't direct the remake of The Ring, the American remake of The Ring. So it was Gore Verbinski, wasn't it? And then
Who actually did a reasonably good job of it.
Yeah, quite a good one. Yeah. And then he went and did Nakata directed the second Ring 2 in America. It was, I don't think that's ever. That's purely unprecedented. I can't think of too many decent transfers that have come over there. I can't think of a director that's really come over here and sort of massively blown everyone away. I can only assume it's the money.
One would imagine. Maybe the opportunity to play to a larger audience. I'm sure that's what they would have you believe. But on the evidence of Bangkok Dangerous, and I have to say, Nick Cage's ridiculous haircut. It's up there with Tom Hanks's Da Vinci Code effort, folks.
So it's a fine hairpiece. Yeah.
His hair was particularly bad in National Treasure 2 as well. So it's something of a theme of late for him.
It's fine in a tragic sense, in sort of so bad it's cool kind of way.
No, you look in National Treasure 2, it looked like he had a horrible undercut, and it's don't know what he's doing.
Not even Nick Cage is doing, Drew. So we may never know. Bring on National Treasure 3, I suppose. Rock and Roller is being billed in some quarters as a return to form for director Guy Ritchie, though a strange number of former admirers seem now to be turning their back on his first two films after the twin debacles of Swept Away and Revolver. Having sworn off London wide boy gangster films for good, Ritchie has seen fit to renege and come back to what he knows, which seems reasonable in the face of his squandered popularity. Having reinvented the British gangster genre as a wisecracking cultural phenomenon first time around, is Ritchie's return to old stomping grounds a reason for celebration or another nail in the coffin? I haven't been to see Rock and Roller yet. I have mixed feelings about the prospect of seeing it. Drew, did you enjoy Rock and Roller? Is it as good as his previous, his first two films?
Well, here's the thing. It's a very enjoyable film. It's entertaining. It's witty. Pretty much as you'd expect. But I've seen this film before because it was his first two films, largely spliced together.
Scott, is that a sentiment that you would concur with?
It's fairly accurate. I mean, I have some sympathy for him. I mean, I don't think he could have done any right in this situation. I have at least some small respect for Revolver. It was a really bad film, but at least he was trying something different there. And I mean, Swept Away, you can't really. I suspect his arm was twisted into that one.
Well, I suppose on the point you're trying to make there, Rock and Roller could easily have been his third film, but at least he had the moxie to attempt something more
depth. I believe what would have happened is if he hadn't went off and did something different, he would have ended up doing Layer Cake, which Matthew Vaughn went on to do. Ritchie must have produced it, I think.
It probably sickened him that he did such a good job of it as well.
Yeah, but I mean, if he'd done Layer Cake, which is a great film, and I'm sure he'd probably have done much the same job with it Matthew Vaughn did, but I would say, oh, it's the same film again. And there's certainly elements of this being the same film. However, as long as Guy Ritchie can keep making quite a good same film continually, I'm happy enough to watch it every 3 years.
Yeah.
It seems to have divided critics, doesn't it? And it seems to balance on whether or not you can put up with that sort of. Well, I suppose Ritchie was always the sort of British imitator of Tarantino's style, isn't he? With a sort of contrived dialogue, and no one quite speaks that way. It's quite a sort of strangely removed form of dialogue and whatnot. And if you can tolerate that sort of thing, and if you enjoyed it first time round in Snatch and Lock, Stock, I dare say you probably quite enjoy Rock and Roll. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly the same stuff where he introduces about 12,000 characters, each of whom get about 2 minutes of screen time and as such come across as really broad stereotypes.
And all have improbable...
So it's Jack the Act and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. They all have, improbable idiosyncrasies.
Yeah.
This man loves this painting. It's his favourite painting.
For some reason. Yeah. So... And his plots are like candy floss. There's an awful lot of them, but it's not particularly filling. And it's the usual sort of thing of plot progression, more through happenstance and coincidence rather than any sort of driving force or motivation by the characters.
Yeah, it's the largely the film comes across like a series of loosely connected sketches.
Yeah.
Vignettes rather than it being an overarching plot that...
Richie's always been the sort of music hall version of the crime caper, isn't he? He's the vaudeville settings, and it's all lots of cockney story about going knees up Mother Brown.
I'm sure he would have liked Revolver to have been as long Good Friday, but he seems to do much better when he's sort of taking a lighter stance, if one can, with cockney gangsters.
Yeah. And, I mean, I'm starting to sound very negative about this, but I did really enjoy... Rock and Roller. It's very funny. It's about as witty as Snatch and as the two good Richie films. It's a worthy entry to his little Mockney trilogy. Yeah, I actually quite like it. It's definitely worth going and seeing. I've seen a lot worse films, some by Richie himself.
Drew, would you be happy enough if Richie's promise at the end of the film of the characters returning for the real Rock and Roller, would you be happy enough with that?
What I felt about this film was that I had seen it before, but I didn't particularly resent that because I liked the first two films. I liked Lock, Stock and Snatch, and it's funny. It was witty. I enjoyed it. Another part of me wishes for some more originality, but again, if he's doing the same film again over and over, but it's still entertaining, then well, good on him.
If he can come up with enough interesting variations on a theme, then why leave that theme, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, he seems to do it very well. And so if he's going to do the real Rock and Roller and he can maintain that same standard, then I will be looking forward to it.
Oh well, that's it's assuaged my anguish at the prospect of it. Actually, you may well have convinced me to go and see it. Having previously invested his talents in the realm of talkie-talkie relationship movies, director David Gordon Green has shocked some fans by taking on board Pineapple Express, the latest stoner/slacker comedy from the stable of producer Judd Apatow. Apatow fans have delighted, however, lighting up box office dollar signs and making the tale of a hapless loser pothead and his dealer on the run from a murderous cop one of the most successful movies at the American box office this year. For some, the joke is beginning to wear thin, but what say our renegade review panel here at The One-Liner? Scott, I quite enjoyed some of Apatow's previous films. I wasn't so keen on Knocked Up, but certainly Superbad had me in fits of laughter at points. Is Pineapple Express up there?
Yep, another... very enjoyable film from the Apatow stable. A strange idea. It's a mix of the kind of stoner comedy, which has been about for Lord knows how long, and eventually this sort of comes across as Cheech and Chong mixed with Die Hard or something. It's a very strange film. It's not the sort of film that a plot recap would help you explain why it's actually good or funny. Again, it does fall into the trap of being something of a loosely connected series of little skits and plots. Mm-hmm. What really saves it is not any sort of strong narrative, but some excellent performances. Seth Rogen's great, James Franco's whimsical, childish drug dealer's a suitably silly character for the more grounded Rogen to riff off, and I've always liked Gary Cole, and his shouty gangster's a great amount of fun here. It's almost an absurdist comedy at points, given the concept of the film is so high, it could quite easily fall on its face, and it's perhaps surprising that it manages to hang together so well, given it is at times a parody of the stoner genre and a parody of over-the-top action films.
So to someone such as myself who hasn't seen the film, on paper it sounds like it should be an absolute mess, but does it prey enough on its improbable situations and draw enough humour from that to rise above?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's the very last scene is essentially parodying itself quite badly. As the characters are just sitting about discussing how silly it all was while having their breakfast. It's a very absurd scene, but it's the whole film is saved by knowing just how silly it is at points, and it's quite obvious it's not trying to be any serious drama or anything. It's just simply trying to be a fun movie, and that's exactly what it delivers. So yeah, very happy with it.
Drew, did Pineapple Express float your boat?
It did, not to the extent that the likes of Superbad did. I don't think it's quite up there with them. But again, it's to do with likeable characters and the actors playing them very well. And yeah, it's completely daft, particularly Danny McBride's character, who apparently channels Boris the Bullet Dodger from Snatch and just cannot be killed by conventional weapons. lots of very silly moments where people are getting shot lots of times and then not dying, and sort of typical stoner jokes. And it's not taking itself seriously, and it works. And yeah, it's good, it's enjoyable. Not as good as I was hoping for, but better than a lot of films I've seen of late.
Is it not beginning to grate a little that Seth Rogen seems to be casting himself constantly as a bit of a deadbeat, but with hot girlfriends?
I hadn't actually thought about it that much.
Well, I had. Damn him. In that case, then, it sounds like we have a recommendation there on both fronts. Pineapple Express, Chiba Chiba. For some time now, Ben Stiller has been able to do little wrong at the box office, the blip of the Heartbreak Kid remake aside. Juggling family-friendly fare such as Night at the Museum with offbeat romanticism such as Along Came Polly and downright ludicrous comic hits such as Zoolander and Dodgeball, Stiller has become one of Hollywood's most bankable stars. For some, the wheels look set to come off, however, with his latest effort, Tropic Thunder, arguably falling foul of the mantra that the bigger the budget you throw at a comedy, the lesser the results will be. The film follows a group of actors from varying backgrounds who are shooting a Vietnam War movie and who, through a series of contrivances, are forced to take on the role of soldiers for real. The film has drawn numerous criticisms, not least for Robert Downey Jr.'s controversy-baiting performance as an Australian actor who blacks up and refuses to exit his jive-talking persona throughout the entire experience. Is Stiller crossing a bridge too far, or is the box office success of his latest film reflective of its quality? Scott, I've read a lot in the papers about Tropic Thunder being a mixed bag and that it starts out quite promisingly, but kind of loses momentum under the weight of its own ambition. Is that the case?
No. It's really good. Any other questions?
Yes.
What are this week's winning lottery numbers?
I mean, again, like Pineapple Express, it's such a high concept it's such a high concept film that it could quite easily just fall flat on its face, and again, it's, I suppose, somewhat remarkable that it doesn't. I mean, I've heard some interviews with Stiller where he's talking about the fact that at some point it was going to be a 4-hour film. There's enough footage cut for a 4-hour cut. And, well, I'm glad he's had the sense to rein it back in a bit, because it is one joke done quite well, and it does stretch it a little bit, but for the most part it does manage to just about pull it off. Stiller playing an amalgam of every notable 80s action star with a career on the slide, Jack Black essentially being Eddie Murphy, and Robert Downey Jr. quite clearly being Russell Crowe. again, it was the same interview where Stiller was forced to defend the fact that it was like, well, Downey Jr., obviously Russell Crowe then, is like, no, I'm sure there's lots of Australian character actors and we're really just, you're not fooling anyone. It's clearly Russell Crowe. Yeah, it's the Stiller trademark big dumb comedy. It's Zoolander with more guns, and I can't think of anything wrong with that.
Considerably more violence as well.
Oh yeah, there's some lovely bits of silly gore in it. It's a sharply observed script. I mean, if I've actually got one criticism, it's not with the budget or anything, it's the fact that it's a little bit insidery. You'll probably have to have at least some knowledge of studio politics and certain actors' pretensions to get most of the stuff that's being thrown at the wall here. But most of the stuff that's thrown at the wall does stick, and it is very funny.
It's interesting you say that, because as much as I've enjoyed, I suppose, most of Stiller's comedies, I have found him to be ever so slightly narcissistic. Is that something you would agree with, and is that on display here, Drew?
I would say to a degree, and I tend to worry about Ben Stiller films, and much as I love Dodgeball and Zoolander particularly, you keep seeing him nowadays in bash like Meet the Fockers and Night at the Effects Factory, as you dubbed it, but yeah, he's pulled up a very, very funny film here, and the fact that he's not on screen so much helps. But I know what you mean, the narcissism. He's on screen a bit too much, and a little bit self-indulgent with these little mentally handicapped character too.
That's drawn some flack in the States, hasn't it, from groups defending retards?
Yes, I believe so.
Entirely unwarranted, as usual.
Yeah, almost.
Shut up, you retard.
No, you're a retard.
Dude, what have you stopped for, you retard?
Yes, that's retarded.
Yes, totally retarded. Yeah, there's not any real problem with that character being handicapped. It's more just that it's not really that funny and it's on screen too much. The only problem I have with it is the level of funniness, not whether it's making fun of somebody or not. Because frankly, I don't give a shit.
Yeah, I mean, that whole character there is essentially send up the usual Oscar thing of only giving Oscars to people who are slightly mentally handicapped.
Yeah,
I'm sure the whole like half hour he's on screen is to set up about four or five gags in a scene where two people are walking through a forest, which is a bit over the top, but I don't know, kind of works.
Yeah, well, it's largely there to just for him and Robert Downey Jr. to have a conversation about going full retard. his example being the examples of Forrest Gump, who was a retard but still managed to do things well and have a business, so clearly hadn't gone to full retard, which is why Tom Hanks got the Oscar.
That's anything that inappropriate, I'm sold already. I am going to have time to go and see Tropic Thunder.
Yeah, I was worried about this, and for the same Ben Stiller reasons I said, and the fact that Jack Black's in it. When I've said before, Jack Black being in a film isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's pretty much never a good thing. And I think, oh, great, a Jack Black film.
Yeah, there's this strange battalion of people out there who seem to think that Jack Black's appearance in any film is an unbreakable seal of quality, and I've never quite understood the Jack Black bandwagon.
Unfortunately, I've been quite lucky of late. I mean, he's been in things like Be Kind, Rewind, and pulled stuff off quite well. The problem is actually resolved in this film, though, because Jack Black's not actually in it. He's played by Brian Dennehy, circa 1972. If you've seen the trailer, you'll know what I mean. It's clear it's Brian Dennehy and not Jack Black. But I forgot where I was going with this. How did we start?
We started talking about me falling down a hill.
A bit like, how did we start with this film?
Is it any good?
Yeah. Is this film any good, Drew?
Yes.
If you had to rate
I'd said I was a bit concerned about Jack Black being and the Ben Stiller thing. It just turned out to be thoroughly bloody funny, and it pretty much never drops.
If you had to rate it out of 31, what would you give it?
26.
Fair enough, that's fairly high accolade. Tokyo Kakeru Shoujo, or The Girl Who Leapt Through Time to You and Me, comes with the dubious credential of Mamoru Hosoda as director. The reason for one's trepidation comes with the knowledge that Hosoda-san formerly directed Kiddy Cash in Digimon the Movie. A gentle tale of a schoolgirl who discovers she can hop back and forward through time at will. Is The Girl Who Leapt Through Time Japanimation light, or is there something more substantial behind its whimsical facade? It was my intention to catch up with The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, but I haven't quite had the chance yet. Scott, I know you, well, both you and Drew have seen it, so would you recommend it?
I certainly would. You disparage the director, and okay, I think Digimon's not the best example, but it is from the Madhouse Studios, which you probably recognise more from the Sublime Metropolis and the affecting Perfect Blue and the laughable Wicked City.
Fuck, they blew up Moyart's plane.
That aside, this is it's about this girl, right, who leaps through time. It sort of sells it short a little bit, but in most respects, it's an ordinary girl, Makoto, who goes to school, plays baseball with her best friends, the dependable Kusuke and the flighty Chiaki. So far so usual, until one day when she's riding her bike, the brakes fail and contrive to engineer an unfortunate train-flesh interface that by rights should have killed her if she hadn't discovered that she had this ability to jump back in time to that morning. On discovering that, she basically attempts to work out what's happened to her and then see if she can control this phenomenon, which it turns out that she can, and she eventually spends time trying to avoid pain and embarrassment to herself and her friends as she attempts to basically engineer a better day for them all. As is usually the case when meddling with this sort of thing, it leads to many other unanticipated changes, and she's bouncing back and forward through time trying to fix things and all that sort of thing. However, the whole time-travelling gimmick's pretty much just a hook to hang what is, for the most part, a melancholy exploration of friendships and love and missed opportunities, as the dynamics of the three friends change in various ways for various reasons. The take-home message seemed to be that even if you could go back in time, you can't stop it marching back on again. Now, while I've not seen an awful lot of animes lately, this has to be one of the best that I've seen. The characters are all utterly charming, and the film has this endearing sense of understatement, and it's free of most of the kind of ludicrous excess which this kind of thing quite often could go down. The characters feel real and restrained, apart from an understandable but sort of ill-advised ramping up of the cheese and the tears to try and give you an affecting ending, which I think would have played a lot better had it remained sort of understated and a bit less over the top. But if that's a flaw, the only other one's actually the time-travelling itself. As soon as it starts having to explain why this girl can jump back and forward through time and engineer some sort of... which essentially plays a part in engineering the finale, it does become a little bit dull. It does quite literally grind to a halt. That means that the last 20 minutes are actually something of a letdown. However, about the first hour and 10 minutes in front of that are an absolutely delightful experience. It's very touching. It's a very human story, and it probably shows more than anything else how far away Pixar are from actually being great storytellers rather than great renderers.
Drew, a lot of sources have acclaimed this film for quite purposely underplaying its initially high concept. Does it deserve the praise it's received?
I'm not sure, because it becomes so important at the end too, in a very clumsy way. I mean, it's not that there's anything particularly noteworthy about the animation, to speak about that for a minute. Although, it's not of any higher standard than a lot of other animes you're likely to have seen. But it is very, very pleasant to view some hand-drawn anime for a change, as opposed to the screeds of utterly charmless CG-rendered creations more prevalent nowadays. And it's also got quite believable teenage emotions and reactions, so there's no character attributes are in any way over the top. So it's just a really, really good film, and makes a pleasant change from 3D rendering to.
So maybe not an absolute anime classic then, but is it going to tide over Japanimation fans until the latest from Studio Ghibli? Does it fill that gap nicely?
I would say no, simply because it's just one film, and really there ought to be more, more released in this country. But it's very good, so it's got enough quality to fill a gap. It's just that one film doesn't do it, rather than this film not being good enough.
Excellent stuff. First-time director Hong Jin-na has found himself in a position most would love to be in, with his film The Chaser already earmarked on its foreign release posters with the promise that it is soon to be remade by the team that brought you The Departed. Where that film was a substantial, if ultimately inferior, translation of its Hong Kong predecessor, The Infernal Affairs Trilogy, one hopes for better results with the American adaptation of this South Korean tale, as its central premise of a serial killer attacking Seoul prostitutes and the former cop turned pimp who tracks him down soon loses momentum amid schizophrenic pacing, convoluted plotting, and the now obligatory Korean hammer violence. What is it with those Koreans and their hammers?
It's hammers and slapping. The two often have to go hand in hand too.
I find myself thinking that I hear about Tesco expanding into the Middle East, and I can't help but think that if B&Q did the same in Korea, they'd make a fortune off hammer sales. Seriously, Korean people are just walking about in the streets fucking each other over the head with hammers and then slapping each other if you dare to pass comment.
Yes, I've been in love with the whole Korean slapping people ever since Public Enemy, and I have not tired of it yet.
It just seems to be ingrained in the culture, doesn't it? And I imagine in Korea it's fairly passé. It's kind of sort of the equivalent of someone muttering, fuck you. You just walk over and slap them in the face. But
And also, unless it's a problem with the way it's translated to English, there are also so many Korean films, as well as the hammers and the slapping particularly, also very commonly use the phrase crazy bastard, far more commonly you'd expect to hear in English.
I'm assuming it's some sort of Korean phrase for which there is no sort of literal translation, and they've found this useful umbrella term of crazy bastard and they throw it in at every given opportunity.
It has to be very prevalent in these films though, doesn't it? Like a stock insult.
I was disappointed by The Chaser. I thought it started out, it seemed quite convoluted and quite muddled, but then so did Old Boy. You weren't quite sure what was happening, and The Chaser, I thought, okay, I'm going to hold out, I'm going to see what happens. But I feel like I've been sold a bit of a lemon here, and I feel like we're at the back end now of this sort of trend for Korean cinema, and we've reached the point now where we're not getting the cream from the top of the from the bottle anymore. Any Korean film that seems to have made more than a certain amount now is obligatorily, shoved into a multiplex and expects to garner the same praise as something like Old Boy did. But where Old Boy was an extremely worthy film and a genuine advancement of the artistic cause of cinema, I'm sure most people would argue, this just seems like the Public Enemy sequel, actually, in that it's there purely for the purpose of it, and it suffers from some very convoluted plotting, and it was a mess, basically, wasn't it, Scott?
I can see what they've tried to do with it. I can see where they've had their idea, but it's one of these whodunits where from the outset you know who done it.
That's its hook, isn't it?
Now, what they were trying to do was be trying to take the sort of standard ten a penny. I mean, it's a serial killer detective investigation, of which there are 79 million of them already. Mm. Now, turning that on its head is a stupid idea, but it could have turned into something interesting. But I can see kind of why you might think it might be have some worth to explore the concept, but it turns out that it simply doesn't. This film is essentially about 90 minutes of police bureaucracy as they try and work out how to gather enough evidence to prosecute someone who's already confessed to their crime. Mm. And I don't quite understand it. It seems incredibly convenient to the way it's structured, where the guy gets released for some reason which doesn't make any sense.
This is my problem with it, in that you take a film like Old Boy, and it appears to take place almost in an alternate reality, and it hangs on its own it builds its own internal plot logic, and it can hang certain things from that. Whereas a lot of other films, that's leagues ahead of a lot of other foreign cinema, where still there's a kind of immaturity to the structure. And you come across something like The Chaser, where we've come up with this concept of having this crazy serial killer, and he's going to be in the first 10 minutes he's caught, essentially. And then, oh, right, okay, and the whole premise is we're going to make sure he's going to get away on a technicality and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so explain that technicality. Oh, it's just that, it's a technicality. We're just, for reason Z, he has to be, this nebulous reason, we're going to let him go, and then we can hang, you know, we can plot the rest of the film thereafter. And it doesn't follow any particular logic, and it seems to fall back on this just because reason quite a bit.
Yeah, and even then, I just simply didn't care by that point. I mean, the whole middle stretch of the film is someone trying to find evidence for crimes that have happened. But okay, I know what the crime was, and I know who did the crime.
The middle bit's now no longer important. Smashing some girl's head in with a hammer.
Yeah, so this whole, all you're essentially doing is filling in paperwork for an hour, and I'm not interested in that. And as a result, I wasn't particularly interested in the film. Something of a disappointment.
Definitely. Drew, would you concur with that?
Yeah, I don't really have much more to add. It was just a bit pointless. It didn't seem to have any particular hook to keep you going. There wasn't a lot to hold your interest. You just, I know what happened. Why are you trying to find this stuff? Because you don't really have enough reason to care about the girl that they're trying to save in time.
No.
And it's just
she's
all,
got a kid.
All waste.
That's it. she looks a bit sick. Oh, well. And now she looks a lot worse.
in a way, I'm almost glad that films like this are being opened up to a multiplex, regardless of the quality, because it's encouraging people to take an interest in something other than the Hollywood summer blockbuster. It's just that, unfortunately, Korean cinema, Japanese cinema is increasingly emulating the style of the high-concept American blockbuster, and they're releasing tripe now, which kind of emulates that, instead of following through with films... like Park Chan-wook's Vengeance trilogy. There are a great number of directors who seem increasingly eager to capture the attention of America, presumably so they can follow the Pang brothers and go to Hollywood and be given a wad of cash to make crap with. So it's a bittersweet experience for me for that reason, and that I'm glad that foreign cinema has been given a greater chance. It's not just the cream of the crop that we're seeing, but at the same time, anything other than the cream of the crop seems to be just cookie cutter American wannabe pap, basically. And for me, The Chaser, it's not irredeemably bad. It tries to do some things interestingly, but it just doesn't quite pull it off, as far as I'm concerned. Quite a disappointment. It's at this point in the podcast where I go like this, open up a big bag of lightly salted Doritos and a munch one, and I let Drew tell us about The Strangers. Drew, what's that film The Strangers all about?
We all know that the legend based on a true story before a film generally means has approximately sod all to do with a true story. But The Strangers breaks entirely with this tradition and as good as admits to it. The film begins with an introduction which amounts to a lot of bad stuff happens to a lot of people. Some bad stuff happened to this couple. No one has any idea what, so this is our conjecture. Beginning with scenes of a bloody knife and arterial sprays on the walls of a house one morning, accompanied by the audio recording of a young boy's 911 call, the film jumps back to the night before and tells the story of Kristen McKay and James Hoyt as they are besieged in the Hoyt family's summer home one night by masked evildoers. And unfortunately, nothing really happens, bar some people try to get in their house. They're a bit scared, and then you have the typical horror-stroke-slasher film mistake of leaving the area they had managed to safely ensconce themselves in. There's no tension, and the whole thing is utterly unmemorable. And I can personally testify to this fact, given that when I was preparing for this podcast, I had to look up the film in IMDb and read the plot synopsis before remembering that I'd already seen it. And there's not really a lot more to say to that. And
do these people who are terrorising them at any point phone up the house phone and go, "Do you like scary movies?"
Fortunately not, no.
Excellent news.
But yeah, there's not really a lot more to say to that. I mean, the acting, I suppose, from Liv Tyler and Scott Speedman is entirely competent, but there's just nothing happens. It's such a long time with so little action interspersed in it, and it's utterly unmemorable.
Scott cans The Strangers has films burgers, or can it do one?
It can probably do one, but I don't really want to start laying into this film either. It does a few things that I like. I think it would have built tension quite adequately if it hadn't outright told you at the start that the main characters die. Now, when you do that, it basically reduces the rest of the film into a guessing game as to when they will die and how they will die, rather than how if they will survive. I think if it had been a question of whether they survived or didn't, it would have been a lot better film. It would have been a lot more. I would have cared a lot more. I would have actually invested something into the characters rather than just wait for them to die.
Well, there seems to be a point if you didn't know the outcome. A horror film to a waiting game, doesn't it?
Yeah, it pretty much scuppers any route to build tension. And you don't need me to explain why that's less notable. I mean, it's a better rehash of Halloween than Rob Zombie's version was. I like the fact that someone's trying to do a horror film that's more based on at least attempting to build tension and has, you know, humans as a bad guy rather than some, you know, zany supernatural entity. It's doing things that I like and would desperately like to say made it a good film, but it doesn't, and it's just quite a lot dull. It feels awfully stretched, even at 85 minutes. This feels like a half-hour program that's been pulled and pulled and pulled. I mean, it even repeats certain scenes during the middle of the film. I think we should at least twice, probably three times, there's one of the masked characters slowly stalking along behind one of the heroes. And it's just all a bit pointless in the end. You've seen this umpteen times before, and you'll see this umpteen times again in your life, and this is, as you say, completely unmemorable.
Man. That's enough Doritos for now. I fear I've gained infinitely more enjoyment from those than I would have from watching The Strangers. Well, everyone, thanks for joining us on our big comfy cinematic couch for another week. We hope you enjoyed our ramblings. We will be back with you hopefully sooner next time, Scott. Am I correct in saying?
I hope so.
We hope so. But in the meantime, you're just going to have to live with the lingering memories of our fantastic selves until then. So for now, I've been Craig in Liverpool and Scott was Scott in Glasgow.
Catch you on the flip side.
And Drew was Drew in Drewville.
Fare thee well.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll speak to you again soon. And right, everyone's seen The Chaser.
We've all seen The Chaser.
Wizza, 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 wizza.